From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, has turned 70. And to mark the occasion, the foreign ministers of all the NATO nations gathered in Washington, D.C. There has been significant tension between the U.S. and its European allies in NATO under President Donald Trump, who has sought to undermine the military cooperative that was historically aimed at fencing in Russia's imperial ambitions. Trump's main quibble has been that he feels NATO allies expect the U.S. to pay disproportionately more for its defense budget. Those tensions were on display in Washington, D.C. over the past week. At an event marking the anniversary, Mike Pence, vice president, lashed out at NATO members Germany and Turkey for their dealings with Russia. And in his address to Congress, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said, quote, "We have to be frank. Questions are being asked on both sides of the Atlantic about the strength of the alliance." Joining me to assess NATO's legacy is Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written numerous books, including Understanding ISIS and The New Global War on Terror and Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Welcome, Phyllis.
Good to be with you, Sonali.
So let's remind ourselves. I mentioned that NATO was essentially formed to curb Russia's imperial ambitions. Can you give us a very quick history of what happened 70 years ago that led to NATO's formation, that the NATO nations felt required this military cooperation?
Well, it was essentially the response of the victors of World War II. It was often said that NATO was created to keep the U.S. in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. That was kind of the framework of the alliance. It was to be a military alliance created in 1949, just a couple of years after the end of World War II. And over the years of the Cold War, which was already taking shape by that time, it became the kind of Western military alliance that was challenging Soviet influence around the world, and particularly challenging the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact, which was essentially the other side of the Cold War military equation. By 1999, for the 50th anniversary, it was pretty clear that the Cold War was over. It had been over for almost a decade by then. And the rationale for NATO was, according to anything logical, was over. So there were a lot of calls by that time for NATO to simply disappear. Those who supported it could say, okay, it did its job. Those who had opposed it from the beginning as a militarized response to the Cold War that was making everything worse and not better could say, okay, it's now time to acknowledge that it's over, it's done. But instead of that, the NATO high command met in 1999 and decided that instead of ending its role, it would simply claim a new rationale to do the same thing, to be the military force around the world led by the United States. But instead it had to pick a new ally because, of course, there was no longer a Soviet Union. Russia was a weak country at the time that didn't provide any sort of military challenge to anyone. So instead, they went after Serbia. The Kosovo bombing that took place in 1999 was part of that. Even in 1995, when the U.S. And NATO began the bombing of Serbia in its involvement in the former Yugoslavia wars of that era, the decision was made by the Western Alliance that because they couldn't get approval in the Security Council of the United Nations, which is the only way it would have been legal under international law, instead they said, we're going to ask the NATO High Command for permission, which of course is not acknowledged anywhere in international law. They just sort of made that up, that they could do that. And of course, being a military alliance, it's like when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you're NATO, everything requires military intervention. So NATO took on this new job of being the arm of the West against Serbia, which was seen as potentially allied with Russia. It was a very messy war, as people will remember, and it was a devastating war for the people of the former Yugoslavia. Following that, after 9/11, NATO for the first time used Article 5 of its charter, the only time it's ever been used, which is the basic thing that says that an attack on one NATO member should be included as should be treated as an attack on all NATO countries. And therefore, it was going to ally with and participate in the U.S. war in Afghanistan and later the U.S. war in Iraq in the so-called global war on terror. Of course, NATO troops right now are still fighting in Afghanistan alongside U.S. troops. There are NATO troops in Iraq as well. So we have this very difficult scenario where NATO is kind of becoming the arm of an alliance now against Russia, potentially against China. What it should be has changed dramatically from its post-World War II origins.
So currently, the only place it's militarily active then is Afghanistan and Iraq, which go back to its cooperation with the United States. Enter Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is basically trying to distance NATO allies, complaining about their defense budgets. But what is, as far as you can understand, Trump's position on whether NATO should remain belligerent towards Russia? We seem to have this sort of bizarre relationship that Trump keeps trying to prove. He truly does see Russia as an enemy, but then does the opposite. This past week, we saw Mike Pence getting upset with Germany and Turkey for defense contracts with, buying Russian weapons, and I believe it was an oil contract with Russia. So what is the Trump administration's position on NATO currently vis-a-vis Russia?
As far as I can tell, the Trump administration does not have a position on Russia. Trump seems to have a position that changes quite frequently.
Yeah.
And others, some in the administration, including Pence at the moment, Pompeo at the moment, John Bolton at the moment, have taken very strong positions against Russia. But those have been rhetorical positions. When we look at what the administration as an administration has done, they have come out in defense of NATO where it matters, meaning in the budget. The US military budget this year, which is higher than ever, it's now up to $750 billion, just an incomprehensible amount of money, includes a significant increase in the money designated for European commands that are designed to work with NATO. So all of Trump's own rhetoric about NATO being irrelevant, which he said at times, it's over, it's done its job, it should disappear, all of that has been rhetorically clear, but completely in contradiction to where it matters, which is about the money. If you follow the money, you see that the US is continuing to put huge amounts of money into NATO, and of course to demand that NATO members raise higher amounts of dues on their own. The US position is that every country that's a member of NATO should pay 2% of GDP into the NATO treasury, which is something that no other NATO country, with I believe one exception, I think it's Greece, is the one European exception. No other NATO countries are prepared to do that. Some of them have said, well, maybe we'll try, but so far they're not doing it. So you have this very contradictory set of policies where you have, as you mentioned, Vice President Pence chewing out the representatives of Germany and Turkey for dealing with Russia. You have Pompeo focusing on this issue of all these countries need to increase their dues to protect them against Russia. But you see, of course, the president himself refusing to come out squarely and identifying Russia as the target of NATO. Now, this is particularly important right now because last year, for the first time in some years, the U.S. intelligence agencies collectively issued a new strategic assessment. And for the first time since 9/11, they identified not the threat of terrorism, whether it was Al-Qaeda, whether it was ISIS, the so-called global war on terror as the primary enemy. But now they are saying that the real role of the U.S. military is to challenge countries that threaten it directly, specifically China and Russia. China in the South China Sea, Russia perhaps in the Middle East, perhaps in Syria, perhaps in Europe. But it's the threat of China and Russia essentially going back to the Cold War as a focus on what is possible for defining an enemy for the United States. So it puts NATO again at center stage of U.S. military strategy because NATO's enemy traditionally has been Russia.
So does that mean that Trump is embracing NATO because he may see the value in having these alliances, even though there were these tensions on full display last year? There was that iconic photo of German Chancellor Angela Merkel looking down alongside a lot of European leaders at Trump while he sat with his arms folded like a petulant little boy. And it seems as though, now several NATO countries are eager to find new reasons for NATO to keep existing. I mean, and this is at the same time that we're seeing these fractures both in Europe and the United States politically with the rise of right-wing authoritarian governments and then the liberal leaders kind of watching in alarm.
We're in a very strange moment right now, as you say, Sonali. If we look at the language Trump has used, he has been very dismissive about NATO. And even some peace activists, some others who have been longstanding critics of NATO, have jumped on that and said we should stand with Trump to be against NATO. I actually see it a little bit differently. I think we should look at Trump as the equivalent of a broken clock. A broken clock might be right twice a day, but it's still broken, and we still should not rely on it to tell the right time. We should not be allying ourselves with Trump pretty much on anything. Independently, we should be saying that NATO has long since, if it ever had any legitimacy, I don't believe it did, but for those who think it did, it's over. It's done. Its job is long over. The problem that we face is that we're looking at a scenario where Trump's position is to say, on the one hand, I believe Vladimir Putin. I believe what he says more than I believe my own intelligence agencies about a number of issues. I believe that NATO maybe is over and done, but we want to continue funding NATO. We believe in NATO, he'll say at another moment. So there's a complete sort of incongruous inability to have a coherent position. So I think that what we're looking at right now, relative to this relationship between Trump and NATO, the NATO leaders are very much afraid of what Trump is doing, not just last year, but this year as well. The reason there was not a NATO summit, what was originally planned, where it would have been a very high visibility, grand meeting with presidents and prime ministers from all the NATO states coming together, the reason they didn't do it was because they were afraid that Trump would destroy the festivities, that he'd get up and say something terrible about NATO. They didn't want to have to deal with that, so they downgraded it to a meeting of foreign ministers, which was a one afternoon meeting here in Washington.
So let's also talk about the fact that there have been some protests. You mentioned that there is an, the anti-war movement has seen NATO as illegitimate. When NATO was deployed to to Afghanistan, I remember there was a lot more, of course, outcry around its role there. And this time around, during the 70th anniversary commemorations, there was some small protests. I know Code Pink led some protests, but it seems as though there just isn't that level of scrutiny from the American public toward NATO, and a new poll found that NATO actually is quite popular among the US public. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there's two things going on. Having to do with NATO specifically, I think part of it is this tendency among some, particularly Democratic Party leaders and some others, many liberals, who have taken a kind of, if Trump wants something, we don't. If Trump supports something, we're against it. And the problem is, as I mentioned earlier, this notion of Trump as a broken clock, twice a day he's going to be right. It's not twice a day, we don't see that. But it's also like, you could use the analogy of the infinite monkeys. If you give an infinite number of monkeys an infinite number of typewriters, eventually you'll get Shakespeare. If you give Donald Trump an infinite number of tweets, eventually he might say something right. That doesn't mean we should be embracing his position. Separately, we need to be critical of NATO for all the reasons that we've said no to NATO for so many years. The last time I was tear gassed was at a no to NATO protest in Europe on
Wow.
the 60th anniversary of NATO 10 years ago. This is a long-standing movement of the international peace movement as well as here in the US. So I think part of the problem is people have to get past this notion that if Trump says something bad about NATO, that doesn't mean we should embrace it. NATO should not be embraced. It's a militarist response. It was a major cause of so many wars during the Cold War. and it's something that should be over. On the question of the peace movement more broadly, I think we're still struggling with the needs for the peace movement to reclaim a kind of positioning that it had during during the years of the Bush administration and the early years of the Obama administration. But many things got in the way of that. The biggest single factor, I think, was the economic crisis of 2008 that turned progressive movements in general away from focusing primarily on interventionist wars and instead towards the economic crisis that was having such an extraordinary, devastating impact, particularly on communities of color here in the United States and globally. And it means that for the peace movement to get our key issues, whether it's opposition to NATO, whether it's cutting the military budget, that's how you're going to fund the Green New Deal, for instance, is by cutting the military budget. It means that we have an obligation to get that information into the hands of the activists and the leaders of the movements for environmental justice, the movements against racism, the movement for women's rights, the movements for LGBT rights, for labor rights, for immigrant rights. All of these movements are where the peace movement needs to be focusing its energy to get our information into the hands of those who are working on all of those issues. Because at the end of the day, ending wars and cutting the military budget is the only way we're going to be accomplishing all of the extraordinary, exciting new proposals that are emerging not only within progressive movements, within social movements, within the left, but in the halls of Congress themselves. If we have any hope of funding the Green New Deal, funding Medicare for All, funding free college education, funding jobs and infrastructure and education, it's going to require cutting that military budget massively.
That's a great point it's a great point to link the amount that we spend on the military with all of those questions we constantly get asked by members of Congress about, well, how are we going to pay for it? I want to stay on NATO briefly. You mentioned Europe was when you got tear gassed at an anti-NATO protest. Have there been protests in Europe this year, or even just sentiment in Europe toward NATO this year during the 70th anniversary commemorations? All I saw were some small protests in Edinburgh and Scotland.
I think there has been protests. We were very lucky at one of the events this last week that was involved with the anti-NATO protest here in Washington at a conference on last Tuesday. There were members of peace activist organizations from the UK, from Russia, from Germany, from Brussels, from a couple of other countries who were bringing the European perspective. Peace movements there are somewhat stronger, I would say, than all of the peace movements here, but they are doing very similar work. We have very similar struggles trying to link issues around anti-war struggles with movements against Islamophobia, against xenophobia, movements for immigrant rights. All of this in Europe, like here, is being connected. So I think that that's a very similar situation. The demonstrations were not huge. I think it's hard to build demonstrations when the center of gravity of the meetings is going on across the pond. But certainly there have been protests in Europe as well. But there is also a similar problem among some liberal parliamentarians somehow beginning to look at NATO as if it was the same as the European Union. So it's a very complex moment for some of the same reasons as it is here.
And then finally, do you hope that NATO and its funding and the funding of the military budget becomes an issue with the presidential contenders? I mean, we see someone like Bernie Sanders making the links and his resolution on ending the U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen has passed both the Senate and the House. But beyond Sanders, we don't see very many other presidential candidates taking aim at the military budget, calling into question whether NATO, 70 years after it was formed, still needs to continue to exist.
I don't know if we're going to see the same kind of debate about NATO, but I can promise that we will be seeing much more debate in the future about the possibilities of cutting the military budget. There are already new kinds of budgets emerging from social movements. The Progressive Caucus in Congress is doing their annual budget that has a small cut. It's not enough. My colleagues here at IPS in the National Priorities Project are working on the possibilities of looking at perhaps as much as $300 or even $350 billion dollars could be cut from the military budget, and we would still be safe. This is what we have to focus on. Number one, we need that money to pay for a Green New Deal, for Medicare for all, for jobs, for infrastructure, for education, et cetera. And number two, we don't need that money to keep us safe. Going to war around the world is not what makes us safe. And we have to make that judgment. Are we safer with good jobs, with education and a healthy population? Or are we more safe sending soldiers and bombers around the world to kill people, making other people hate us? What makes us safer?
Right. And again, these are questions that just don't get into the conversations. Have you had a sense of the or what is your assessment, I should ask, of the media coverage of the 70th anniversaries of anniversary commemorations of NATO? Have you seen enough critical coverage or any at all?
Absolutely not. There has not been enough critical coverage. But I think as this congressional reality, the new Congress, the fact that there are for the first time there's a whole cohort of new, young, progressive, mainly people of color, including Native folks, including Muslims, including African Americans, including Latinas. This is an amazing moment in Congress. And I think the people running for president who expect to get Democratic votes, progressive votes, liberal votes, are going to have to keep up with some of the challenge that's been set by those new members of Congress. And in that context, I think we are going to see, as this election goes further, we are going to see much more debate. It's important that it's happening among social movements. That's where it has to start. That's what changes history. But eventually, members of Congress, congressional candidates, and certainly eventually presidential candidates are going to have to address this issue as well.
Phyllis, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. And we've been discussing NATO's legacy on its 70th anniversary. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes and our video channel on Vimeo.